Hello and welcome to Willosophy. My name is Will Anderson. I'm the host of the podcast. This is our first episode back after a big break. Thank you to everybody who wrote to me and asked for the podcast to come back. I've been struggling a little bit this year with finding guests for it, finding the reason that I wanted to do the podcast and what the podcast was going to be about. When I first imagined it, it was about talking to interesting people about if they had a philosophy and what that philosophy was and how it manifested itself in their lives, I guess. But I just didn't want to talk to a bunch of strangers. I wanted to talk to people who were connected to my life so people could see a little pattern of, okay, here's me and my influences and the people I know, and maybe I know a wide range of people, and that gives people a little bit of a, you know, different insight into that you don't always have to be amongst like-minded people. There'll be people on this podcast who share completely different philosophies, opposing philosophies to the ones that I have. So welcome back. If you're tuning in for the first time, I'm going to post the older episodes back later in this series, but this is the first one, and it's a great first one, perfect first one, in fact. It kind of sums up the mission statement of what I'm trying to do. There is one thing I'm going to keep from the old format, which is this. This is how I used to start the podcast, so I'm going to start it this way with my new guest. Who are you?
I am John Safran.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But am I meant to like who am I within me or something like that? Is that the point of it?
I just like to see what people say. Sometimes people lead, like, you know, with their job, like really solidly in that. Like, I am John Safran. I think that is probably a perfectly honest and probably the most honest, like, you know, that's the place to be. But some people go, I am John Safran and I am a book, like I wrote a book, or like, and then you go, okay, well, that's immediately how you identify yourself.
Well, the two things that spring to mind when you ask that question is I was once in a Buddhist monastery in Japan and I had to sit with this Buddhist monk, and the koan he gave me, like, that I had to meditate on, I had to go off and he said, who are you? Go off and meditate and come back. And I kept on coming back and trying to come up with answers. And every answer he, like, rejected, which was just getting me more furious. That's when I knew I wasn't a Buddhist, maybe, because I guess you meant to become calmer and calmer.
Can you remember what, like, the order, like, some of the order of the process you went through in trying to, like, say who you were?
I don't know. I think I was like, well, I don't know. Like, I was like this. I was all a bit squeaky. And I said, like, oh, you know, I do documentaries. That's why I'm here. And he goes, no. Who are you? And he goes, come back. And then, like, I came back and I was going, oh, is this going to be something where I have to say, oh, I am nothing? So I went back.
All right. So you went back to what answer. You thought the answer should be.
I am nothing. Right. I am Noah.
Yeah, and that wasn't the answer either. For last year's exam.
And that wasn't the answer either. So I was like really furious that who I was, which I thought I wasn't the right answer, nor was my suck job answer the right answer. And I honestly can't remember how that ended. But then years later, years earlier, but I only talked about it years later. I was once backstage with the Beastie Boys because this was before I was on the telly or anything, and it was because the night before their DJ Hurricane, had been at the Lounge in Melbourne, this bar, and he started chatting up my then girlfriend.
Right.
And then
you thought, this will get us backstage.
Yeah. And then the next thing I know, like, he was like, hey, I can get you two tickets. And next thing you know, we had tickets. And then afterwards, he kind of like ushered me backstage to meet the Beastie Boys, so he could, like, try to bust a move on my girlfriend.
You are the first person in history who's had the Beastie Boys as the wingman. Yes. That's basically what you were.
Yes. And so then I was backstage and there was Mike D and Ad Rock and MCA and they said, who are you? And I said, oh, I'm John Safran. He goes, yeah, but who are you? And so I thought, because I was quite interested in spirituality and I knew that they were Jewish, or two out of three were Jewish, one was half Jewish, I said, oh, I'm Jewish like you. And then Ad Rock said, I'm not Jewish or whatever, which was, like, really weird because he was, like, definitely biologically Jewish. And then they kept on going, who are you? Who are you? And, yeah. So and anyway, I put that piece together years later for Music Jamboree, and someone contacted me and said, oh, my God, isn't it, like, weird that these two tense moments in two different series over the years is someone like, who are you? Who are you? And you not being able to answer.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting place for us to start this, and I guess it's why I start with that question, because I guess that's what this podcast is about. Mm. Who are you? who are we? You know, who am I? It's, I guess it's all those things, the thing that we are asking ourselves and trying to define in ourselves every day. So I will start with the other big question and we will go on from there, which is, do you have a philosophy? Do you subscribe to a philosophy? Have you ever had a philosophy?
I think I've had several, but the one that comes to mind immediately when you asked me before the mics were turned on, I was going, oh, what is my philosophy? He's definitely one of them, which is the sky doesn't fall in.
Oh, that's good. I already like that a lot. Okay, and, explain more what you mean by that.
And people use the excuse that the sky is going to fall in to sort of like not do things.
All the time.
And
it's probably the number one, like, I mean, across everything that we do in our lives,
yep.
The number one thing that prevents us from doing what we actually want to do is the idea of what would happen, what are all the bad things that could happen.
And I think the reason this really cemented in my head when I was quite younger was because I was reading this, in university, I'd always try to like find out, you know, all the names of, I'd want to read their books of like, oh, who are these big names that everyone talks about? So I read this biography by Edward Said, who's this Palestinian writer. And so people are going to be really annoyed that I've like nicked this Palestinian writer's philosophy, but hasn't like applied it to be a freedom fighter or anything. I've just applied it to my actual life or whatever. But and anyway, so he
classic white privilege.
Yes. So he talked about how, because he was talking about how everyone makes a big drama that they can't stand up for the Palestinians, and like they make this big hoo 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 hoo, and it's really scary. And he just goes, you know what? He was saying, listen, I'm a Palestinian activist, and you know what? The sky doesn't fall in.
Right.
So something as sort of like as heated as that, he was just saying people totally exaggerate, according to him, how like the consequences if you're going to like take that the political stand or whatever.
I even find that like on a very micro level. I was thinking about this week, you know, because there's all this debate in Australia in particular, and for our overseas listeners, there's a national broadcaster called the ABC, which is publicly funded. Cost taxpayers about 12 cents a day each, you know, but it's a massive organisation and provides services right across the country. But there's been some, you know, possibly ideological budget cuts, you know, proposed by the government. But then on the other side, in Victoria, they just had a state election where all the major newspapers said that they should re-elect the Liberal government, and the Labor government got in.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those weeks where you're going, we spent all this time arguing about all this like excess power and who's biased and who's, but like most of the time people just do what they think.
Yeah, yeah,
like
for
all
sure.
The papers said you should keep these guys, and everyone just went, yeah, fuck you, papers. You know, like this is the time this is not even biased. This is the time they're just telling you outright. And things change and the sky doesn't fall. That's a very micro level to what your thing is. But
because at the same time as I was reading this with Edward Said, I'd started doing my own stuff, and I'd kind of annoyed Ray Martin, which I'm sure some of your listeners, Australian listeners, will remember.
Well, talk us through that a little bit.
Well, I did a piece of shtick. I was doing a documentary looking at the media because I just got into the media myself, so I was like really fascinated by the scaffolding that was like just out of shot, like how you put something together and how you re-edit things to manipulate things, like things I'm totally desensitized to now.
Right, but you had the tourist's eye, like a thing that in stand-up comedy is very powerful, you know, being able to go to a place with fresh eyes and see things that they see every day, and so they don't notice how absolutely ridiculous they are.
Yeah.
You had that. You were a newcomer in an industry and you hadn't like been training to be in that industry all your life. You suddenly were catapulted into it and you were like, why does this work like this?
Yes, for sure. So I did this documentary that looked at that, and one of the things I did was...
You're a disruptor.
Yes. One of the things I did was to like do a bit of an examination, flipping the tables of this guy called Ray Martin, who at the time was hosting a show called A Current Affair, and he was like the big archetype of current affairs programming where journalists would go out and stick their foot in the door and shame shonky electricians and shame the unemployed.
It's one of those classic examples of a power media, at the time, the most powerful media organisation in Australia, protecting and run by the most rich and powerful man in Australia at the time, distracting the general populace from the things that are being done at the big end by pointing out that there's just honky washing machine repairman down your block or whatever, right?
Yeah, and there was no social media to fight back. So if you were shamed on this show, There's not much you could do. You could, like, try to write a letter to the Green Guide. You could try to write a letter to the Media Watch on the ABC. Maybe they'd take your case. And anyway, so the current affairs had gone after this family called the Paxtons because the youngsters in the family apparently were offered jobs on this holiday resort and they refused to take the job. So he was like, this is... the reporter was like, you know, these bums, why are they lazy? So anyway, that had become a big thing. So anyway, so I did a thing where I kind of flipped the tables and I turned up to Ray Martin's house and kind of pretended I was outraged that he, like, didn't wake up and didn't get to work until 10 in the morning. And it was really perfect what he did because he finally came out.
Right.
And he shoved his hand in front of the camera, just like all the shonky people had shoved their hands in the camera, and he grabbed me by the collar.
Yeah, it was like you've learned nothing.
Yes.
Did you watch none of those clips?
Yes. And so he looked absolutely guilty of something.
Right.
And really, he wasn't guilty of anything.
No, if he'd just come out sensibly and normally and just gone, you're an idiot.
Yeah, but I also wasn't I wasn't literally accusing him of being lazy, but because he thought he had to explain himself. He goes, listen, I was at work until 11 last night. I'm often at work till 11. So the fact that I'm not at work, it just said to me how much you can make someone look guilty.
Right.
Yeah, so the point for me wasn't
really. Yeah, he was guilty of nothing, really.
He was guilty of nothing, really. But I'd somehow managed to make the host of the current affairs show that does this all the time look guilty and do exactly the same things as all these innocent members of the public.
So what hope does anybody else have?
Yes. Anyway, so that happened, and then, like, he was the biggest guy in the media.
By the way, I think that's why we love when we have, and if anyone's never seen this, you should Google a guy called Corey Worthington. Do you remember the party kid, Corey Worthington? And there was that famous interview on A Current Affair, I think it was, where he just nailed it. It was just one of those things where you were just like, oh, you won. How did that happen? Like, I don't think he won on purpose, but he won nevertheless. It was like a majestic moment, like a David versus Goliath moment. Okay, so.
So everyone was telling me that, like, because the next day, pretty much my show was pulled and everyone at the ABC was kind of bullshitting and pretending it had nothing to do with Ray contacting them and bringing me down. But anyway, people just told me, like, this was an awful thing that had happened. Like, it's over.
Yeah.
My career is dead now because I've upset the wrong people. And then, I don't know, then the sky didn't fall in.
Talk me through, though.
Because I
think this is an interesting area, and I think it would be interesting for people to hear this because I think, you know, that idea of failing, and not just the idea of failing, you know, because that keeps us from so many things, these ideas of failing that we've invented that probably will never happen. But here's a time where it did happen. You were just doing something that was in your, you know, world.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise anyone who knew anything about what you did up to that point that was the sort of thing you were doing, right?
Yeah.
So you, that could have been any of the things that you did that went wrong that way and suddenly you're not working. So what were you thinking at the time? What was your reaction at the time? Were you angry? Were you disappointed? Were you shocked? Were you confused? Like, what were you going through?
I have an artistic impulse as opposed to an activist impulse, but I trust that if I'm feeling that something artistically is feeling right or whatever, that it's feeling right because it's saying the right thing, like it's saying a moral thing or whatever. So I was just feeling like this had really good energy to it, this thing I'd done with Ray Martin. And so on a creative level, I was like, oh, this is like really interesting. And this was like before, you know, The Chaser and Sacha Baron Cohen and I hadn't seen Michael Moore. So it was like this weird thing where I couldn't even quite figure out what this sort of, you know, what the precedent was or something. Right. But there had been precedents, obviously. There'd been like everything from Candid Camera to yippies in the 1960s who did these kind of social activist pranks. And so I guess that was sort of like the precedent. But yeah, it felt like really good energy creatively. And so they kind of, it killed it. And then in a time before YouTube and viral hits, people started taping it onto, like someone at the ABC clearly had dubbed a copy and passed it on around on VHS. And it became, there were two things in the world at that time that were doing this. It was the Pamela Anderson sex tape and the Ray Martin fight.
Right.
And then it started this bubbling up all across Australia.
Well, I remember seeing it.
Yeah.
In that format. You know, I remember being past the tape, you know?
Yeah. And I walked past
eventually, basically, you started Netflix.
And I was walking past a pole at outside RMIT, this university in Melbourne, and there was this pole, and it had Socialist Alliance or something presents a film night on the media, and they're going to play this tape at their film. And it got out, and ABC didn't know what to do because, they're still just such arrogant assholes. But even then, they're arrogant assholes because you could kill things back then.
Uh-huh.
Like now, they'd probably think, how can you bury anything? But they buried it and like slandered, you know, like they instead of just coughing up and just.
I mean, it's insane when you think about, like, in the light of particularly in what people do today.
Yeah.
With the point you were making and what you were doing.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it could have been a scandal for a day, and maybe like the Australian and the right wing press could have beaten up on you for 6 months until, you know, the Chaser did something or someone else did something and that can be the person for that 6 months. Oh, Cate Blanchett made a speech at a funeral. Okay, cool. John Safran, you got 3 months out of the press, you know, like, but the idea that the ABC, this organization, and an organization that I've worked for 15 years on and off, you know, would not stand up for the principle of that.
Yeah.
It's against everything that they should stand for. It is embarrassing. It's disgraceful. That's the thing that the right-wing press and the Australians should be beating them up for. They should have been beating them up for not standing by it.
Yes.
Like a valid piece of, like, you know, media and social criticism like that, where you didn't actually, like, it's not like you framed him for being a pedophile or anything like that. You literally were making a comedic execution of a very valid point of a current news story. It's an embarrassment to Ray Martin, and it's an embarrassment to the ABC. But I guess, like, even for Ray, it was before that time. Like, I don't think Ray Martin or the equivalent of Ray Martin would behave like that. It's like, you know, when the politicians started to ruin the Chaser by being too into it.
Yeah.
Like, because the minute they're too into it, you're like, oh, well, this is ruined now.
But I actually enjoyed it at the time, because when it started bubbling up and became viral, I was like, oh, this is actually cool. Because it was sort of like the environment I'd grown up in this kind of countercultural environment where I loved, like, public radio and I loved zines and all this. It kind of seemed to fit into that world for me. So I was like, oh, this is actually really cool that it's sort of gone viral on VHS.
I want to linger on that moment if I can, and we can get back. We'll take our time. But that cool thing, I think, is just – I do want to ask you about that, because I know – because before I met you and knew you, I was a fan of yours. Me and my friend Lyndall, my friend Lyndall and I had watched Race Around the World. We were big Doug Anthony All-Stars fans, and I guess this is kind of the point I want to make with this podcast, is like often things are connected. You know, I started watching The Big Gig and I got into the Doug Anthony All-Stars, and we followed Richard Feidler to Race Around the World and we saw you there, and then we followed you from there to, like, you know, to the other things that you were doing before I got to meet you and know you. And we were both really big fans of yours. And I remember at the time just thinking, this guy's about as cool as it fucking gets right now. You know what I mean? Like, so did you have a sense of, like, at least sometimes in the middle of it going, you know what, this is pretty fucking cool?
Oh, yeah. No, I thought I wasn't really that angry at the time, because it was a combination of maybe they were telling the truth. Like, because they didn't say that. They came up with this thing where they said, oh, listen, we just don't think the quality of the overall show is any good. It has got nothing to do with the Ray Martin thing. So they kind of, like, cornered me, like, what am I going to say without sounding like a wanker? Like, because perhaps it's true or whatever. So the combination of that and also me kind of finding it really cool that it was going viral or whatever. So I didn't mind that. But then it was only, like, years later. So I actually kind of didn't mind it at the time. And then, especially when I started doing other things that were working, it was kind of like, you know, in the overall, you know, opus of your work, to have this one thing that was, like, buried but then became – it's kind of like a cool little chapter in it or whatever. But it was only years later that I thought, you know what, it was absolutely just this unique situation that the ABC just being a-holes worked for me. Like, it was just incidental that them being the overbearing kind of overlords and trying to shut me down because of my character or persona – And because of the style, it kind of fitted in perfectly. It was like accidentally fed the brand or the marketing of me or whatever. But for anyone else, it would have just been, they were just total a-holes. Right. And so I was thinking, I'm not going to like let them like, you know, that just should be on the record, because it's absolutely just absolutely incidental that them being total jerks to me. Because what they do,
right? And
they sent me, to give you an idea of what jerks they were, they sent me legal letters, and I got advice from the ABC that I wasn't allowed to comment on this.
I mean, that's,
and then at the same time, they went out to the media and like just slammed me, and so I was all. Yes, there's a absolute jerk moment.
Oh, I will tell you a good example of that. The guy who runs the ABC, Mark Scott, who seems to be doing a good enough job trying to defend it. I don't know. It's not my business. I don't technically work for the ABC.
Yeah.
I haven't technically worked for the ABC for a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was at Triple J, I worked for the ABC. But since then, I've always just worked for TV shows that, you know, play on the ABC. And... but I have never spoken to Mark Scott, even though we have had the number one show on his late network. Right. Like, we haven't spoken because when he first came in, they were cancelling my old show, The Glass House. And they told me I wasn't allowed to speak in the press. And then he went out in the press and said that, like, you know, the trouble, like, because people were getting angry about it being cancelled. Like, the most complaints the ABC has ever had, even more than that infamous Chaser sketch Julian Morrow told me, is when our show got cancelled. So people were angry at the time. And... and then I was just like, no, fuck him. He can't, like, I'm an adult human being. I can say what I fucking want. No one can tell me what to say.
Yeah.
Like, the minute someone's trying to say, you can't say that, no, fuck that. You should be defending my right. And people can believe me or not believe me. Yeah. And you can put your argument forward and I'll put my point of view forward and people can make up their own mind.
Yeah.
Fine. But... to tell me that I can't speak about it, it's fucking outrageous.
I think the thing in that case is that it's really annoying because they don't want to... If they want to market them or position themselves as that, fine. Just position yourself as this monolithic overlords of the Australian media who tells people to shut up. But you can't tell you to shut up and me to shut up and do all this thing behind... and then still, like, present yourself as loving and, like, the good guys.
Right.
But they're not. They sent a legal letter. I went on community radio where after the Ray Martin thing, where they surprised me on the community radio by playing the audio of the Ray Martin footage. And the ABC sent legal letters to me, like, threatening me for... and threatening the community radio station for them playing the audio. And so that's how hardcore they were.
Yeah. And well, let's hope that they're not like that anymore, because I still wear this. So I should be a bit nicer. No, I mean, I think this is a perfectly legitimate conversation to have, but it's a conversation that people are afraid to have, I think, sometimes, because we're so opposed on things like public broadcasting in Australia that people can't make legitimate criticisms of the ABC. It's like this thing of, like, I think these current cuts are hurting all the wrong people. Yes, there are probably places where the ABC could be doing a lot better job than what they're doing, but we can't have a legitimate conversation about that because everything's so split along ideological lines and they're fighting a war instead of actually looking at it and trying to improve it for everybody's sake.
Yeah, I think things can be two things at once. So I think it's true you can stand up for the ABC, but they are, like, it's the only game in town. Mm. It is a cultural monolith. So they should be... poked at and discussed and, you know, criticised.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
And I think that it's one of these things that I'd like to get your opinion on this. When it comes to politics, are you a person who would publicly identify, you know, your political point of view? Do you have a political, like, you know, would you, if I said to you, you know, how would you identify politically? Would you want to answer that? Do you have an answer for that? Has your answer to that changed over your life?
No, I wouldn't want to answer it, but not because I have some big da-da thing. Like, oh, you'll be so surprised because behind the scenes I'm actually passionately this or that.
Right. The reason I hang out with all those racists is actually because I'm really racist, and when I'm pretending for those 2 days for documentary footage, it's the only time I feel alive.
I also feel like in the context of Australia, that's always like, well, are you...
That's a good movie plot, by the way. It's like your Cosby moment. You know, because it's turned out that Bill Cosby, instead of being the most beloved entertainer of our generation, is probably one of the most horrible serial rapists of all time.
Yes.
Yeah, you could do a thing about a guy
who... I wish I didn't say yes, seeing I don't really know the facts of the case. Sorry.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. I did say it seems. I didn't say, you know, this is not a legal podcast. It'll be fine. Otherwise, we can be the first podcast to be sued, and that'll get us in the press, and that'll be good for the numbers. So anyway, it'd be about a guy. You could do a great movie about a guy who did your job, but yep. He actually is like not pretending when he's with them. He's only pretending to be a good guy to make documentaries in his real life.
Yeah,
but he's
sure.
actually just a terrible person. And,
yeah.
he's
and I've been caught in the clan hood in a non-shtick situation.
Right. Anyway, that was not the point. I got sidetracked.
But I reckon it's a combo of things. One thing is that I managed to get into little worlds in Australia and around the world, and part of that is because people within those worlds say, oh, John, you don't come across as being too ideological. Like, you'll give us a fair say whether that's – and I hear that from all sides. So I kind of don't want to damage that.
No.
And also I just don't think, like, what do I know? I have this thing where issues, if they're in, like, the mainstream and everyone's talking about them, I think, what am I bringing to the table? Like, I don't feel, like, guilty, like, oh, my God, if I don't talk about the environment, you know. Everyone's just – not everyone, but other people are just way more informed, and it's a topic that's discussed so much by people more informed than me, so I'll just go off in my little world and try to poke around at something that's not discussed as much.
Well, funnily enough, that's kind of the answer I would give, like a very similar sort of answer. And this is why I brought up the point in the first place, is that I think that most of us are much more nuanced than identifying with a certain, like, you know, like following politics like it's football. Yeah. And identifying with the team. Like, what's important to me is not going to be important to you, and vice versa. And this idea of, okay, well, this debate is interesting to me, but this one isn't, or I'm more concerned about my family than I am about the environment, or whatever, are very personal decisions. And so when we start to label things, and the ABC starts to be left versus right, instead of people just going, well, what do I care about the ABC, and do I think I'm getting value out of it, and do I, instead of it being an ideological debate, I think those labels are very unhelpful, and we become increasingly aware of.
I think there's so much to discuss that's not within that divide. Like, right. I've just finished reading an advanced copy of John Ronson's new book.
Uh-huh.
And he's the guy who wrote The Men Who Stared at Goats and The Psychopath Test and Them. And anyway, the new one is, and it's not coming out till next year, but it's about public shaming. And it's about, and the sort of the spine of it is looking at these people who've been destroyed because they've said something kind of clunky on Twitter, and then it's the most, and the mob goes after them. And anyway, this book kind of like looks at that phenomena. And one of the examples is this woman who's kind of been attacked. Like, when you think about it, it goes, oh, the kind of people who've attacked her have been kind of progressives because she said something that was interpreted as racist. And then, but the other girl he discusses and looks through her story is this woman who did something that was interpreted as offensive to the military. So she was kind of like attacked by conservatives for that. And anyway, but the book, just the way he's written it, it's almost like it doesn't really occur to you that much that it's like, oh, in this case, it's the progressives who are the mob. In that case, it was the conservatives. Because he's trying to make this bigger point and tell this really important story about public shaming in 2014, where he's comparing it to shaming in the past where people put in the stocks and fruits.
Well, that's what
fruits
it feels like, though.
And because John Ronson, like, doesn't approach that book from, oh, I'm left-wing or I'm right-wing, he can tell this incredible, interesting, nuanced story and a discussion that so needs to be had. So I kind of, like, feel like I'm John Ronson-y like that. I kind of want to talk about things that aren't talked about that don't fit into that divide.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that. That was a good answer. Okay, that brings me, because we're going to flip around, but I want to talk about what you're doing right now, or the reason that, you know, you're in LA at the moment, and yep. I went and watched you do a little talk at Book Soup.
That's such a good bookshop.
Oh, my God.
I was so excited because every time I've come to Los Angeles, I've kind of somehow ended up there. It's almost like just walking the streets, and it's such a great bookshop. And then I knew I was doing a book event here, but I didn't connect the dots. I didn't know that was called Book Soup. And then when I got there last night, like, I turn up and it was like, oh, my God, I'm getting to talk at this gorgeous.
It's an amazing place. Like, it's just down the road from where I live, and so I often pop up there, and they do look. Yeah, you can see authors speak all the time. You know, and I've seen lots of great comedic authors, like Judd Apatow did a speech about some short stories that he collected, and Patton Oswalt did a great one there. But, like, you know, great authors coming through all the time as well. And but because of your book, now, I imagine some of the people who are listening to this will have already heard of your book, but for those who haven't, what is it called? It's had two names.
It's got two names. It was released in Australia in 2013 under the title Murder in Mississippi, and that's what it was released at in Britain as well. But just last week it was released in America, and it's titled here, God'll Cut You Down.
They're just like, it just needs a little bit more. Yeah. Why did they go with God'll Cut You Down rather than Murder in Mississippi?
I really like the name, but it was mainly because I think to foreign ears, to Australian ears, it's very evocative, those words like murder and Mississippi. It's so vivid and colourful. But I think if you're in America and you kind of hear the word Mississippi a bit more often, right. Suddenly it's just also, bit plain.
I think you also hear the word murder a bit more often. Yeah. You probably hear murder in Mississippi every second night on the news. So you're like, yeah. Right, another one? Yeah, is this from the Murder in Mississippi super series? Yeah, I've got 1 through 17.
I think if you had like murder in Chadston, like to Paris ears or to LA ears, it would sound like really, oh, what's this mysterious Chadston place? But if you were to release it in Melbourne, everyone would be like, why do you call it Murder in Chadston? So I think it was that sort of thing. But so what the story is about, it all started with a prank I did for a television series called Race Relations, and I went to Mississippi to meet up with his white supremacist, and it was just like incidental. It happened to be this guy. We just sent out emails to a dozen Klan types, and he's the one who got back to us. And anyway, so I went over there and I procured a saliva sample from him in a very sneaky way, and then, you know, there was a bit of television magic, but like I went to a DNA testing facility with the saliva sample and got it tested, and in effect, all of us, if you kind of dig hard enough into a DNA sample, all of us, you'll have messy things and you won't be as racially pure as you think. Anyway, so I returned to this white supremacist, a meeting he's holding, and I get up at the podium and I say, oh, Richard, his name was Richard Barrett. I go, oh, this is a bit awkward, but earlier on I procured a saliva sample off you and I took it to a DNA testing facility. The results are in and there's no easy way to put this, but you have African DNA. You're part African. And anyway, the room's all like that. They don't know what's going on. And I say, oh, listen, don't worry. It's not like you're black. It's more like you're white and a bit black, like Barack Obama. And then, like, we just scoot out of there, right? So we've done this prank. And then he started immediate legal action against the ABC, and the ABC just wouldn't put it to air. So that was that. It was like the end of it. And then a year later, that guy who I'd spent, because I ended up spending 2 days with him, because for the sake of getting the prank, I had to fake that we were filming a serious documentary, and for like 1.5 days. And then the easiest way to fake you're filming a documentary is to film a documentary. So right. we just followed him around in his world, and we just knew none of this stuff was ever going to be in the final prank story. But right. he was like a really interesting guy, and he was talking about things I was interested in. So I just this fake documentary just ended up being sort of, you know, whatever. But we didn't think about it because we had so much footage to cut that we couldn't like indulge ourselves by watching all this footage. Anyway, a year later, this dude is murdered. He's found dead in his house in Mississippi in a pool of blood, and a young black guy has been arrested. So I'm like, holy hell. And I was like really thrown off because, you know, even though he was held horrific views, Richard Barrett, it was still like, it's just very strange to think that someone you spent time with has just been murdered.
Right. And how did you find out?
Because I was goofing around on the internet and just under the websites I visit. Right. Like, yeah, I'm always... in the book I talk about how I'm like spooling through Scientology tweets and downloading conspiracy theory podcasts and watching exorcisms on YouTube. That's a kind of online world engage in. And so, yeah, I just saw it on a white supremacist site. It just said Richard Barrett murdered, and he hired black help. What was he thinking? Something along those lines. And anyway, so then the story started coming out that perhaps that the first thing that the young black guy called Vincent McGee said to the investigators when he was caught was that Richard Barrett, the white supremacist, had sexually attacked him and he had to fight him off, and one thing led to another, and it ended up with a knife in his neck. So I didn't actually initially I didn't put it to one side. Like, I wasn't like, oh, cool.
Where were you at in your life at that point? Like, describe, you know, what were you doing? Where were you working? What, you know, where was life at?
I was trying to get things up with the ABC, and everything I've done in my line of work has generally been like self-generated. It's not like you get all these phone calls all the time. Oh, my God, I've got too many phone calls. It's usually me coming up with an idea and then kind of like pushing it until someone wants it. So I was just going through that stage where, I was just doing a lot of ideas and hoping at some point someone, the ABC or whatever, or someone would come respond.
And your state of mind at a time like that, like, just, you know, it's just interesting to me. Like, are you positive? Is that a positive time? Is it a time where you start to have fears about like paying your bills or anything like that?
It can be positive if there's hope. If I think there's hope, I'm usually, that keeps me going regardless of what's going on at that moment. Whilst if I don't think there's hope in the future, then even if something's going really cool at the moment, I'm still worried. So I'm like way more worried. Just say when John Safran versus God was on TV and it's getting to the closing weeks, I'm like freaking out. Even though like I'm getting all this great feedback, I'm like, but I don't know what I'm doing next. Well, so I can be in a bit of a like for instance, the fact that I knew the book was coming out in America now, like that's kind of kept me kind of quite bubbly, right, bubbly for the year. And even though it's like, oh, well, hang on, what else am I going to do and all that stuff?
I often like to say to people, one of my favorite things is having a TV show.
Yeah.
Not doing a TV show. Mm. Doing a TV show is really hard.
Yes.
I like when they go, hey, we just agreed to do like Gruen,
yeah,
and we're doing it again in the second half of 2015. Yeah. That's like the best present anyone could ever buy me. Because that means at least until then, yeah, I feel like things are going okay.
Yes, definitely.
Like, once we start doing it, I might completely fuck it up and ruin everything, but like at least until it's like a free pass until like August. I'm like, oh, I still have a career until August. This is okay. This is cool. What's your work day like, or how do you generate ideas when you're in that space, when you're in a creative space? Like, I'm about to go into a space where, I mean, most of this year, to be honest, has been me and my own time. But I'm about to really put together two new shows, and so I need to be in a writing space.
Yeah.
Are you a person who goes out and does things? Is it just trawling websites? Do you get up early? Do you do a couple of hours a day? Do you like?
I've got this advantage of sometimes I'm really late with work due. Mm-hmm. So what that means is there's always something on because I haven't done it.
Yeah.
So for this year, for instance, I've been writing feature articles for this magazine in Australia where I've like gone into like small country towns and looked at a couple of murders and a few other things, hanging out at a white nationalist rally, you know, typical Safran shtick, you know. I hung out recently. My latest story, which I've just put in and back and forthing with the editor, is I spent time with this Aussie jihadist preacher, is how he's described by the press, and he was a convert and he was in the Philippines and he got deported and his passport was taken away. So he has to live at home with his mum now, and you know, his family aren't Muslim or whatever, they're just like white Aussies, and I spent some time with him, but basically I'm either procrastinating or I'm finishing the work. So yeah, so my work day would be hunting down these ideas and making phone calls and turning up and doing the interviews and then transcribing and then writing. So there's a lot to do.
This is a bit of a sharp turn, but I just thought of it while you were talking about all these people that you spend this time with.
Mm.
Has there been someone over the years where you're like, I really did not like this person, but I feel like I learnt a couple of really interesting things from them?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, just with God Will Cut You Down and Murder in Mississippi, both Richard Barrett, the white supremacist, and Vincent McGee, the murderer, had unpleasant sides to them, but you learn a lot. Usually the thing that kind of shocks me these days is because I go into these worlds and I'm kind of like prepared for people to be like really offensive on a like a racial or a ethnic level. Like why? So it's not like, oh my God, I knocked on the door of this Klansman and he said something anti-Semitic. Right. You know, like I'm totally prepared for that. But it's usually when it's something outside that circle, when they say something either just offensive or they do something awful, and I become like a regular person who's like really thrown. And so in the case of like Vincent McGee, the young black guy, when I started hearing about the story of abuse in his life that sort of isn't really to do with being black or white or whatever, like and the abuse that he'd both suffered and also that he'd meted out on other people, and I was just so out of my comfort zone and just so distraught. It was almost like, oh my God, had I known I was going to end up having these conversations, like if this was just, if I knew at the start, I would have come over here.
How have you coped with that? Like, do you feel like you have ways that you, like, because you, as you said, you're often surrounded by a lot of, like, you know, people with, you know, like, you know, energies or, you know, sharing information with you or being around situations that the rest of us would find, like, I would find one of those confronting, let alone, you know, being around those people and in that world and alone and scared. Like, I asked you a question at your book thing last night of just like, did you tell your family and friends you were going? Because I was like, mine wouldn't let me. You said you said to me, I'm an adult. I'm an adult.
I said, I'm a grown up.
Right, you're a grown up.
I'm allowed to go to Mississippi.
Right, but I'm not sure that my friends would let me. I think they would think it was too dangerous for me to be. And I think it would be too dangerous for me to be around that many dangerous people all that time. I don't think I'm strong enough to handle that. What is it about you either that makes you interested in that, or B, what is your technique of coping with that when you're around it?
Oh, so I guess like one level is it's highly stimulating mentally.
Okay.
So that's a bit of the trade-off where you get to talk to people that are just so different to your world, in my case, in Balaclava in Melbourne. And so that's just, you know, I'm sure a lot of people listening are like, well, you know, such an important part of my life, or what I'd like to be an important part of my life, is having a job where, you know, it's stimulating. So this definitely ticks that box. And then the way I cope with it, I guess there's at least two things. One is, It's a bit like if you're going over the speed limit and whilst you're driving, you're not really thinking, oh, this is going to be the time where you have a car crash and end up as a quadriplegic for the rest of your life. You just think this time's going to be okay. Like, you don't even think about it. And so there's a bit of that where once you actually get into the moment and you kind of go into these little worlds, you just think this time's going to be okay. You know, like when you go through the forest and cold call knocking on the door of the Klansman and he opens the door, you just think, this isn't going to be the time where I get lynched from a tree. It should be okay. Then on top of that, what one of the things that really keeps me going is I go to the point of no return, where, and that's two things. Like that's like why when I write things, I like just going into the little town, whether it's in Australia or Mississippi, because you knock on the door and then you're at the point of no return. You can't. What are you going to do now?
Right.
And so there's that. Plus, usually there's some other dynamic going on.
Well, that comes back to the sky's not going to fall in. Yeah. Right. That's your attitude of going, all right. And there is something that about, I think, if you've never made a mistake, or if you've never been in a situation. I always say it to comedians, like particularly when you're first starting, do as many gigs as you can. Doesn't matter if they're terrible.
Yeah.
Because you've got to do terrible gigs at some stage. Like, if you do this for long enough, you'll do terrible gigs.
Yeah.
So you might as well learn how to do them and realize that they don't really matter as soon as possible. And then you'll be able to actually get on with your job. And it may take years, but you've got to get to that point where you realize the sky won't fall in if I take a risk or if I fail. And if I fail, I can get back up again and I can do it again. So obviously in your head, you've got to that point at least a little bit in your approach to these things.
Yeah, for sure. And the other dynamic that's going on that's kind of invisible, I guess, to the reader of the book or the watcher of my documentaries, is that it's taken like a long time to kind of get all the pieces together for this. And there's someone who's backed you, like either at the ABC or at the publishing company. And, you know, and, you know, they've even given you a check. And so, but it's not entirely that, but it's like, I just feel this great shame. Like, I just can't return. I can't imagine after, like, Penguin backed me, of me, like, not handing in a manuscript or not coming up with a story. I'd just be too ashamed.
Right.
And the same with doing a documentary. I'd just be too ashamed to, like, come back and have to talk to my producer at the ABC who back and just go, oh, yeah, well, you're going to have to come up with something because, like, we don't have any footage whatever.
So they were really scary.
Yeah, and it's like... And
here's me eating the minibar.
And shame is... Everyone always thinks shame's a bad thing, but in some ways it's a real driver. I'm filled with a lot of self-hatred because...
Where does that come from?
I don't know. I just guess brought up and just my dad... You know, education was important and I was... I'm a combination of being lazy and a workaholic somehow at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So that means I kind of like procrastinate, but I'm filled with so much self-loathing that I'm always thinking, I'm always writing and I'm so angry. I'm like, oh my God, if I hadn't procrastinated, this would be over by now. And like, I'm so embarrassed. I mean, I was talking about writing for this magazine and I've got an editor there, Ben, and I'm so embarrassed that when I'm late for work, and it just keeps me driving. So it just means I get things in late, but unlike most creative people, I do get it done. And so,
does that have a destructive side to it as well, though? Like, I mean, obviously, that process driven, you know, it gets you to do what you're able to do. But is there an element of that attitude of like self hatred or whatever that you think is negative, or is it just you're fine with it in that sort of?
Well, it's so hard to work out how to get the balance right because, for instance, you kind of have to be lazy for a while to kind of process what's going on. So right. You're not actually being lazy. You're just sort of. Oh my God, I was just thrown into this weird world. Like I spent 5 days recently in Redfern in Sydney because this poster had gone up and someone sent me a photo that they'd taken of it, and it was in Redfern, and this poster had gone up and it said, Redfern for the Aboriginal mob, Asians out of Redfern. It's like, what the hell?
What?
Yeah, it was like so crazy. So I went there and kind of spent 5 days trying to get to the bottom of this poster and what it meant, and was it some outside racist who'd put it on to start trouble? But there was this thing going on there where Asian international students were going to be set up in housing there. So maybe there was like this renegade Aboriginal person. Anyway, so I spent, and you can imagine, like, I'd never thought about this issue before and just getting to the bottom of it, getting my head around this whole thing. And I spent 5 mad days where I'm like talking to people at the gym. And then I find out that there's a Tongan community, you know, within the Aboriginal community, and they don't necessarily get, and it's just like, it's insanely stimulating, but so confusing. And so when I kind of come out of that, I guess you kind of have to spend some time.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's not as simple as I'm lazy because I should start punching it out on the keyboard straight away. You do have to meditate on it like a koan.
Yeah, I often feel like when you're doing creative things that a lot of the time, because you never know what your next thing's going to be.
Yeah.
And when it arrives, you've got to be ready to go. It's very hard to get up to speed on something. Yeah. So basically your whole life, I always think of it as just, I'm just topping up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to fill my brain with like influences and inspirations and be across enough things in the areas that I want to be across that if I go on morning radio and someone throws me a question about something, I at least have a go-to or a funny or like an idea or an attitude or whatever, or something in my brain that I can access, you know, because you never know where what specific thing you're going to need. You just kind of have to top yourself up. And sometimes that's life things as well. Sometimes you can spend, like, I've had a big year on the road, and the thing I feel like I'm going to try to take some time in the next month or so to just do some shit. I don't know what. Like, nothing with purpose, just some shit, you know? Because I feel like that's actually what I've missed out. Like, it's something that I'm not taking in the full influences to, you know, be able to talk about what I want to talk about.
For sure. I was thinking, this is a tip I learned about procrastination, where it's like positive, not positive, but
right.
the best way to do it is like, when I wasn't writing my true crime book and feeling like really bad, what I'd do is I'd read books.
Yeah.
So so I'm kind of feeling guilty because I'm not writing my book, but I am like learning I'm soaking up like the methods that these other writers use to write. So I think, well, I don't know how it applies to whatever's people's thing is, but make what you procrastinate something that's going to help
right.
what you're procrastinating
but also,
from.
But also, even like I'm more on a... Okay, here's what I would like to say. I own your moment. If you choose to do something, then the worst thing you can do is then burden that moment with guilt or shame or those things that like, you know, if you're going, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to watch a movie. Then just don't then sit on the couch and go, oh God, I'm guilty. I should be doing, watch the movie and enjoy the moment and then get up and do the rest of the thing. Whatever you do, be in the moment. Don't waste time. If you choose to go, I'm today going to play video games for 5 hours because it's Saturday and that's what I'm doing, then yeah. do it. But don't, you know, like waste your life playing video games, if yes. you know what I mean. Like, and I think there's like a difference between active in that moment. And absolutely, when you're reading books, I mean, the first thing you would tell someone who's going to write a book is read as many books as you can. Like, that is study for what you're doing.
I reckon I also have this subconscious thing that when I'm doing something else, I'm kind of thinking this might be helpful. Like, right. like,
yeah.
It's like it's a weird thing because I don't consciously think it, but that it's almost like after the fact, I look back at it and go, well, the reason I kind of pursued that and da-da-da is because somewhere in my head I thought this is going to be helpful for storytelling in some way, or I'm going to learn this in some way. And then there's like other things where, like to say even like a book where I'm reading it and I'm sort of going, for whatever reason, this isn't going to be helpful for teaching me something, then like I find it hard to keep on going ahead.
I want to ask you about something that you talked about last night, which is the structure of how you recorded the book. You know, yeah. When you first went there and your writing process as opposed to the second half of it. And I'll let you tell that story.
Yeah, for sure. Because I'd never written a book before and I hadn't written a true crime book. Amongst the books I hadn't written yeah. were true crime books, oh, yeah. right? So... Well, I before I went there, I was reading all these true crime books and trying to like soak up the architecture of them, like the blueprint on them, because I had nothing else to go on. So my logic was I'll soak up how these are doing things, and then I'll go over the Mississippi and I'll just like plonk in my specifics right. into this. And there sort of are blueprints. That's when I started getting positive that. A little positive that even though I didn't know what I was doing, that maybe if I work hard, I'll be able to make this work is because I noticed when I'm watching documentaries or reality TV, I sort of just, without thinking about it, I start soaking up how they're doing what they're doing.
Sure.
In a way that if I watch like a science fiction film or I read a fantasy book, I'm not doing that. Like if you were to say to me, hey, John, go off and write a science fiction, I just wouldn't know what to do and I'd just... collapse, but at least like with documentaries, I'm kind of like even I'm watching Keeping Up the Kardashians or something. I'm soaking up and going, oh well, that's how they kind of tricked that, or that's how they made the story move forward with that.
I've talked about that previously about my love of Sam Simmons, the comedian, yeah. Because I can relax when I watch him do stand up comedy because I don't understand it. I just yeah. think it's wonderful and funny. Whereas when I go to stand up, no matter how much I love it these days,
yeah.
my brain has that thing where. And I'm not sitting there going, I want to see how this is done.
Yeah.
It just starts going, oh, he's doing that. And I yeah. bet this happens and there's that's going to, and like, oh, that, you know, and I'm like, but with Sam, because he is just something else, something yeah. that I don't understand.
Yeah.
I can just kind of sit back and enjoy it.
So I started, when I started reading true crime books, which I'd never read before, I started, the reason why I was feeling a little positive, I was going, oh my God, I can start seeing, I'm seeing the architecture in these things. I'm like, I'm actually just kind of subconsciously soaking up how they're working. A bit like when I'm watching documentaries. So I was going, okay, good. If I just keep on reading true crime books, I'll be able to sort this out. And then I went over to Mississippi. And I tried to be really efficient and productive at the start. So I'd go and interview the district attorney and I'd tape. And then I'd come home that night and I'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'll type up what that was all about. And it was really painful. I was getting a knot in my back and I didn't quite know because at that point, and I didn't know this at that point, I didn't even know that I didn't know, was that you don't really know how you're going to use that district attorney interview until you have your whole adventure and then see how that fits in with the whole adventure. Like, is this some vital thing that goes on for 20 pages or is it just like I pop on in there? And I didn't even know how I was going to, like, present these people as characters and Like it's like the writing equivalent of I didn't know how I was going to film it. And then it took me ages to work out that the way I was building characters was through curating dialogue and curating how I'm talking to them, because then whether people like the book or don't like the book or whatever, like the characters seem real. Like it doesn't seem like, oh, these aren't real. And I did that from getting it wrong so often and then deciding I'm going to curate conversations between me and them, and that's how I'm going to bring the characters alive. Anyway, what you're getting at is at the start I tried to be really efficient and be good and sit there every night and writing, and it was driving me crazy. And then at some point I was so stressed out, and I was getting fat because I was just eating gobbling junk food full of self-hatred and just going off. I didn't know what I was doing. And then I got lazy and I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to, I'll do the next best thing from writing things down. I'll just blurt into my dictaphone, into my Zoom recorder. And I started just like blurting into my dictaphone and filled with sort of hatred that I wasn't writing. I was going, but it's the next best thing. At least I'm doing something. And then for the rest of my trip there, I'd just blurt into the dictaphone when I had something. And then I'd capture everything when I was talking to someone else. Anyway, then when I got back to Melbourne, I started writing it. I realized that all the lazy blurting was being way more helpful than the writing I'd done at the start. Because when you write at the start, even just the process of putting a pen to paper and writing, you're kind of editing yourself in this sort of uninteresting, self-interested way. And let me explain what I mean by that, because that sounds a bit confusing. Is that, to give you an example, at the very start of the book, or very start of me landing in Mississippi, I didn't know I was ever going to meet the killer. And so at the start, I was editing myself in my head, so it never made it to paper, to try to work out a logic that it doesn't matter that I'm never going to meet the killer. So, because then, I took it out of my head. So therefore, I never captured these moments of me having doubt, and then, oh my God, which in retrospect would have been so interesting, and especially because I didn't know it at the time. There's the payoff. I eventually did get to, you know, communicate a lot with the killer and form a relationship with him. So it would have been so great if I had all these moments of doubt and doubt and doubt and doubt, and then ping. But I never did, because I edited it out. So, but if I would have done the lazy thing from the start and not just not given a shit, I would have captured all that. Like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like the book's fucked.
Right. And I think that's less the lazy, and this is kind of what I want to get to. So this is lovely because it's about so many different things. And one of them is about this idea now of here's the thing. This is a theme that I've been talking about a lot, but like the idea that life is not a documentary. It goes back to that idea of left versus right or black versus white. It's stupid for us to look at the world like that, because life is not a documentary. Everything doesn't just happen and it's unequivocal what happened. Yeah. Life is a collection of stories and memories that we weave together with our spin and narrative to, you know, tell our story. And we have some control over that. And this is a classic example of you literally determining your point of view rather than being in the moment. And I think this is what we do a lot, is we get out of the moment and we start, you know, inventing those things that are going to go badly, or we start thinking that we're better than we are or that we're different than we are, rather than being, this is who I am right now. Everything that I am to this point is me now. Let's play this out, this moment right now. And then later on, when I need to reflect, you know, I've taped it and I can collect it, and that will be my version of this story. Because even what you've done with the book is, this is your story of this story.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a story that within itself has a lot of unanswered questions. And some of them, you know, as the reader, you're like, well, are these questions unanswered because John won't answer them for us and he does know, or it's because no one knows, or they will never be answered, or would have a better journalist gone to town and, you know, found them all out, or, you know, is this how, you know, I mean... And it's not their life. You're not going to do another one where you're like, and yeah, here's the rest of it, and you're not telling everything that went before. It's just a story, a snapshot.
Yeah.
And that's, I just think in a broader sense, that's a really interesting idea. As a narrative for your own life, how do you think that you see your life? Do you have a specific meaning? Do you think that, you know, do you have spiritual beliefs that guide you? Is there something within you that you think, you know, what life is about?
I think I touched on this before, unless you touched on it before you hit record, but I trust my artistic impulses,
yeah,
and that there's... But I want to do that because of some particular reason for the journey, even though if I can't quite describe it, or for some particular spiritual reason or whatever, or activist reason or whatever. So,
but where do you where do you think that drive in you to do those things? Like where does it come from? Like, is it just you being a conscious human being evolved and our brains, and you're part of a society and you've chosen this to be the way that you earn your living? Or do you feel like there's something, you know, sort of different that drives you? I don't really know what I'm saying, but do you know what I'm saying?
I think the way I can answer that, at least one way, is I think before, when you're really young, you go through these experiences without thinking about them, and then, like, the horse has bolted, it's too late.
Uh-huh.
That it's sort of like, right, it's like within you. So when I was really young, I was, like, thrown into all these weird kind of cultural things, probably different from, like, a white Aussie being in Australia. Well, like, for instance, I was, you know, I was thrown into this, like, Sunday school where I'm learning all these weird things about God and the Jewish religion, and then... So it's like, oh, well, this is strange. And then on top of that, my parents weren't that religious. So what does that mean, that they're throwing me in this world, but they don't seem to be religious, but they're Jewish or whatever? And then I was thrown into this ultra-religious Jewish school where I was the least religious kid at this. And anyway, I just started being thrown into these weird kind of nuanced worlds within worlds to do with, like, culture. And it just stimulated me. It was like looking at all these unexpected kind of fault lines and the unexpected ways that people act, and the way that people that look like total lunatics to the outside world can be very normal if you're actually within that world. So I just became, I just became interested in that kind of the world of, I guess I became interested in things that look one way if you're only there for a moment. And then when you're deeper and deeper, because you're there for longer, you find out that little world is actually totally different to how you see it if you're, you know, you're just cruising by. And so I guess in a lot of my work I try to do that. Like, I try to spend as much time in Mississippi, so what's on the surface when I'm there on day one, I suddenly see that the kind of cracks and how it's so different by the time you're there for a month. And I just find that process interesting.
You've been around death a lot recently, you know, you're
murdered bodies and stuff.
but I mean, you know, around where death has been, you know, around people who define stories by death, you know, does it make you think about death? Are you a person who thinks about your death? Is that something that is, you know, present in your kind of mind and your existence, or is it just something that you would kind of accept as an inevitable part of being alive?
I don't know if death, but I have noticed I've become really interested in the point of no return in your life's journey. Like, I've done things until this age, and so now I have to somehow deal with the consequences, which is kind of good or bad. Like, the reason
I made me.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's a revelation I had in a situation that I may discuss, like, in like a different episode at a later time. But in a situation that I went through this year, I had like a, you know, one of those moments where I was like, you know, you did this to you.
Yes.
I made me, for good or for ill. This is me. This is what I am. And I'm fucking 40 now. And so I'm going to have to deal with, at least, you know what? Those people are never going to like you. They're done. Like, you can't do anything to win those guys back. And, you know, those people you burnt those bridges with, that's probably done. And those people that you've shared your life with and that you love and they're your friends, they're probably your friends. And, you know, enjoy being with them. You know, I mean, I made me. This is me.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. So you're dealing with that for good or for ill.
Yeah, because I noticed, I started reading these old crime books, like fiction, not true crime, but fiction, like, and famous ones, you know, like Raymond Chandler, and he wrote about this detective, Philip Marlowe.
Uh-huh.
Is that his name, Philip Marlowe? Anyway, whatever the detective is. And I was really enjoying all these books in that genre where it's like this gruff detective and I started reading all these books. I was going, why am I enjoying these so much? And then I realized that in all of it, the character is like this man who's done all these things in his life that he now has to, he's only got one chance to break out of them. Or not one chance, but he has to, like, he's either, like, drunk too much or he's gambled too much, and now he lives in this, like, little abandoned motel room or whatever, and he just has to deal. It's like the point of no return. He's going to have to somehow make this final gasp to sort of make his life work out. And I just think, like, in some weird way, like, that's where I'm at and probably where you're at, where it's like it's too late. Like, you've kind of got your back against a wall in some ways,
right.
And you're just going to have to, like,
and, like, do, you know, and gasps. Even, like, on a lot of the issues of the world, if you look at the bigger issues, I'm like, I honestly believe that, you know, climate change is going to be a problem to this world. Well, I trust the scientists. I feel like that's probably what's going to happen. But I also probably realize that I'll die before the worst of it happens.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, for me, it's not going to be a specific issue. It'll probably be a bit of an issue, you know, but, like, I have a context of, in the grand scheme of this planet and, like, you know, the universe, we're a tiny speck in an accidental speck in the corner of the universe, and we are nothing, you know, compared to any human who will, but you're kind of like, well, I fucking wasted half of it here. I might as well, you know, this is what it is, I guess. I'm probably not going to work out how to evolve to a higher plane or whatever. I might as well just play this shit out, right?
Yeah, I do think that, yeah, once you've gone through real bad things and come out the other side, you do realize, like, what the hell? And, yeah, so I guess that's why I'm not actually scared of the death. But, I mean, it's a bit cocky of me seeing I'm not old enough to ask me again when I'm, like, 70.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I'll be very scared of death then.
I'm going to do this like a Michael Apted thing. It's going to be like every 7 years. I'll get you back. We should finish up in a little bit, but I want to ask you a couple more things. You talked last night about how technology changed your life a little bit, the rise of, you know, YouTube and things like that. Can you talk to me about that?
Oh, yeah. So one interesting thing that happened to my career, like, people who've watched me on the ABC, they go, oh, John kind of went into these worlds for his show where, especially overseas, where they don't know who he is, and then he kind of did a prank or whatever. And then that was, like, fine until Google. Because now, I remember some of my early shows that, like, before Google really took off, so there was, like, the internet, but it was, like, you really could have this roll of the dice that, you know,
Have it on their phone.
Yeah.
Like, if you were visiting some hillbilly in the mountains, he wasn't going to get out his iPhone 6 and be able to Google you.
Yes. And then it just reached this point where, like, people were just always going to know you before you came, or you just have to, you know, they're going to type in your name and then that's that. So I had to be, like, wily and kind of go, well, rather than kind of get petulant or bitter or something like that, just go, well, that's sort of the new world, so I'm going to have to reconfigure and be lateral and come up with some other version of me, or a creative version of me. And I think that's part of the reason I wrote the book in the manner that I wrote it was me having to deal with the fact that my creative world from here on in is people are going to have Googled me beforehand, so I can't just do that stuff I've done in the past. Like, it's like, why fight it? Why not sort of, like, somehow leverage it to something else? And, you just be a... And the other thing is that anyone can... My work is just so honest now. I know that sounds weird, like when I'm writing these crime stories. And part of the reason is, like, the stakes are so high, even though I'm a clown, and even I get the stakes are really high because it's like around a real tense thing. It's like a murder and all these people being affected. So just on a kind of like a being polite or something, you want to be, you know, really honest about it or whatever. But the other thing is anyone can get online these days and say, well, John said this happened in the book, or John said this happened in the article, but you know what? It wasn't. I was there and da-da-da-da-da.
I mean,
so I just know anyone in Mississippi or wherever can read my book or read an article that I do and just say, I was there and that was a bit different to what John. So, and that affects me. And it's weird. It's like this way of really keeping me in check.
Are you sensitive to criticism on a broad level? Have you ever been sensitive to criticism?
I think it kind of, one of the main things is whether I think it's being sincere or not. Usually, I reckon people would be surprised at how not generous, but if I think a person's being sincere and they're kind of, I'm way more fine with it than if I think it's
just someone throwing shit at the wall, sort of thing.
Yeah, or someone who's trying to take me down for some other reason.
Right.
Or,
oh, okay.
The only thing that I can when you say that I really think of, that the only time I was like unexpectedly like really, kind of blindsided by criticism was I did this show Race Relations where like this recurring joke in it. It was all about how within the Jewish community that I've grown up in, there's a lot of like pressure to, you know, marry someone who's also Jewish. And it's just like, it's just true.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but that's not even...
Yeah, and it's like, it's not like I'm an outsider. And it's like, I've been in the Jewish world since birth in so many versions of the Jewish world in Melbourne. It's just like the truth. Like I am an authority about it. But...
I've lived 15 years in the like two most Jewish suburbs in Sydney. And I guarantee you, it's still true.
So then... Then I was just obviously for like some Jewish people, it's like the weird thing about that is that a community, all communities, whether it's the Aboriginal community or Muslim community or the Jewish community, they want to present themselves as like being modern and progressive and not or whatever. And that kind of really kind of bashes against it because it's like, well, what the hell in 2014? Is that still going on? And obviously it's like, is that bigotry? Is that bigotry from the... Anyway, regardless of what it was, I did a show where that was this recurring kind of joke and theme in it or whatever. And afterwards, like some writers in the Jewish press, they tried to like psych me out, like make out a bit like when the Scientologists try to make out one of their members is mad or mentally ill. And I just could not believe, this thing that was just so absolutely the truth, and I have all the authenticity and authority to comment on it. They were trying to like make out because they wanted, you know, it was like they were a bit worried it'd make the Jewish community not look progressive or the Melbourne Jewish. So it's like, anyway, so I don't know. John's got this show on the air, and who knows what it's about, really. And they tried to make out that all the offence in the show, all the transgression had no meaning or had no... It was just like, oh, anyway, so John's just doing this wacky stuff and who knows why. And I just go, screw... And I was like, that really... Because I was so blindsided that I could not believe they were playing that card. And also I just thought, I felt like a Scientologist who's being, or a dissident Scientologist who's being,
but also it's,
shamed it, as it, like, oh, this guy's mentally ill. So I was like really furious.
It comes back to that idea of also though that great thing of like what might be right for you may not be right for some, which is like, why should they care what your perspective on it is?
Yeah.
If they believe in it, for good or for ill, you know, or have the discussion yourself, or defend it, or don't defend it, or just live your life and shut up. But why does it matter to them what you want or you say, you know?
And I think also the other cool thing about criticism in the modern world, like sometimes you get so much feedback, and kind of the good side of that is you get a lot more positive feedback than you used to because people can easily just tweet you or Facebook message you. So you usually, like, to say there's something in the Herald Sun that's slamming you, that like the thing that other people don't know is, oh, for the last years, you know, every time you open up Twitter or Facebook, someone has sent you a little like positive thing that seems sincere and genuine, like, oh, you know, your work's really interesting, John, or whatever. So I've kind of got that.
Oh, like, no, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing is, in the old days when it was only the letters to the editor or whatever, it was always negative, basically, because the only people angry enough to go to a post office are angry, like people who don't like you.
Yeah.
But somebody never liked you enough to go, you know how much I like him? I'm going to get an envelope and it's a stamp. And I'm going to, like, no one did that. But to send a positive tweet or, like, whatever is easy to do. So, yeah.
And also you can learn things from criticism too. Like, you know, God Will Cut You Down, the American version of the book, that's of Murder in Mississippi, is it slightly different. And one of the things that's slightly different about it is I just kind of absorbed some of the criticism. And so when I did the new draft, I took some of it on board.
I always like to try to go, like, is any of this valid? Because even if I hate the person, I've often on Twitter, I've said this, blocked someone for something, but taken the advice on board.
Absolutely. I'm like,
you didn't need to tell me, but to be honest, that was actually a good point. So I'm going to keep it in my mind.
The other thing about criticism is sometimes people, because people aren't critics, so they'll articulate something and they'll, like what they're actually saying, you can pick it apart and go, well, that's not true, that's not true or whatever. But it's more like they're getting at something and you have to like deconstruct it a bit and kind of look at it and kind of go, well, maybe that will help me for the next thing. And I absolutely, criticism has shot my work in different directions in really good ways. So, for instance, a real big way is that some of my earlier docos were like docos but with a little bit of twist, so more Louis Theroux-y. Then when I did Race Relations, I guess a lot of it was like constructed, was what far more constructed, like as sort of like almost like comedy skits but with a bit of doco or whatever. And I kind of just felt that people didn't like that as much. They preferred me in the real in the world and whatever like that. And so when I went off and wrote Murder in Mississippi, God Will Cut You Down, I like took all that and I said, I'm going to make this a documentary as opposed to, you know, whatever, like constructed stick or whatever.
You so, as the, I mean, well, to me, because I'm not a true crime fan, like it's not my area, like, but I read it because I imagined it was going to be kind of what it was like, you know, you in the middle of this story, and I'm like, well, I'm interested in John. Oh, and there's a joke about our manager. That's pretty funny. I can laugh at that in a way that not everybody else can, because I know it's true. And you know, but I guess for other people too coming into that book, but it'd be more, not more interesting, but what's the reaction been like for people who didn't know you before the book? Because there's got to be those people coming as well now, right?
I think there's different things, and I've been getting a lot of for some people, like for Americans, it's quite positive because they don't have this backstory of me, so things are more kind of jarring is the wrong word, but sort of like the whole fact that I'm like quite cheeky the way I express
A character that they are getting to know as well.
So and so the fact that like everyone, people in Melbourne, if they buy my book and they know me, so when I'm like expressing these things about racism in like this real cheeky kind of way where I'm really playing with fire because I'm not being the usual delicate, sensitive thing with the way people, but like Australian audiences already know me or whatever, but American audiences are like, oh wow, this is like like they like it, but it's like they're kind of curious. It's like, why is this person so confident to sort of like express these delicate issues in this sort of like cheeky, politically incorrect way? It's like, oh, and so it can be a bit disorienting for them, but generally in a good way.
Well, you're smashing the microphone stands now. Sorry. like a rock star. So maybe it's time for us to start wrapping it up. Hey, so people can buy your book, obviously, you know, in bookshops where they still exist.
Yeah, it's a nice hardback in America. It's like, because in Australia, everything's, even if you're Salman Rushdie, your first edition of your new book in Australia is softback these days.
Is that right? They're not even selling hardbacks in Australia.
No, they sell these. It's like academic books get released as hardbacks or whatever, but and they sell them in this kind of bigger, it's like taller and form or whatever. So that's the new hardback. And then after they think they've fleeced that, then they release it in this smaller version. Not less words, just like smaller format. But yeah, in America, there's still the old school. It comes out in hardback with a dust cover. And so it's really great. It's like my dad, I always think I'm so tied in with what my dad thinks of things.
Yep.
And like I just know my dad, and I showed him the book, like the hard, he was just so like, oh my God, this is like my son.
Right.
Not only put out a book now.
Finally. Finally son, something I can be proud of.
My son, not only has he put out a book, but now it's like hardback with the dust cover.
I can understand that. I can definitely understand that, mate. Where can people find you, like on the internet and stuff as well? And, you know,
Twitter.
And here's the other thing. I imagine a bunch of your stuff is online because there'll be people listening to this who, you know, I know there's people who come from my other podcast, TOEFOP, who are American listeners and people from around the world who maybe don't know you yet. So they might want to check out some of the stuff that you've talked about.
Yeah, I'm just on Twitter and I guess just, I don't have a YouTube channel, but I guess you can just Google that or whatever. Right. I also do a podcast. I do this podcast, Sunday Night Saffron, on Triple J, which is the ABC Youth Network. And I also did this other six-week podcast that people seem to like, and it's called John Saffron's True Crime. And what it is after I came back from Mississippi, I had conversations with famous true crime writers like John Berendt, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and Anne Rule, and Joe McGinnis. And we kind of will like the idea behind the show is like we're soldiers and like I've just come back from a war and we're going to trade war stories, like about like what happens when you're out there in the field, and then, you know, and it's both creatively what you do and also even physically what you do, how do you protect yourself from harm if you the murderer knows your address and all that stuff like that. So yeah, and wow. that's a 6-week podcast that also and what else? I don't know. The book is called God Will Cut You Down in America and Murder in Mississippi in UK and Australia, out on all formats, you know, ebook, non-ebook, blah.
However you get books.
Yeah, however you get books.
I've read it myself. It's absolutely fantastic, so please check it out. I'm going to do a quick plug here at the end for myself as well. Next week I'm at the Sydney Comedy Store doing my completely improvised stand-up shows, What You Talking About, Will. So 6 of those. And then January 19, the last night of the Willuminati tour, is at the Sydney Opera House in the Concert Hall. There are still some tickets available, so get in for that. That would be really cool. Justin Hamilton doing support.
Are you going to kick me straight out, or can we listen to the Wu-Tang Clan record?
We can listen to the Wu-Tang Clan record before you go. I'm not going to kick you out straight away. That's fine. That's a nice way to end too. Thank you, John.